Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome to Change Leaders Exclusive, a forum that's dedicated to helping change agents successfully deal with the challenges of leading change. We do by having you listen to and learn from world-class change leaders. I'm your host, James Dallas. The topic of today's discussion is how to handle the personal challenges of leading change. Change is always personal because change agents can always count on one thing, that they will be criticized before they are congratulated. Criticism, skepticism, and sometimes just outright unprofessionalism are the ways the status quo fights change. They have used those techniques to wear out and then knock out many a change agent. I refer to that technique as the rope-a-dope. And that term was coined by Muhammad Ali when he beat a much younger and stronger opponent. How you, as a change agent, deal with the rope-a-dope would determine your success and, more importantly, the success of your initiative. We have two outstanding leaders with us today who have led change within different functions, within different industries, and also within different companies that we're going to learn from today. But before we hear from them, let me tell you how we can hear from you on both Facebook and also Twitter. It's at @HJamesDallas, hashtag ChangeMaster. Or you can email me at james@jdallasandassociates.com. Now to our guest, Steve Coonan, CEO of the Atlanta Hawks and Phillips Arena, and Art Hopkins, Executive Director, Russell Reynolds and Associates, an executive search firm. Both have years of experience, and we are just thankful that they are able to join us today. So first, to Steve. Steve, can you describe your career path, going from Coca-Cola to Turner Entertainment Networks to the Atlanta Hawks? How did you make those transitions?
Well, the way I look at a career is that it's a journey of building skills. And so whether it's managing a basketball organization or running a global marketing organization or creating a hit TV show, it's all about having a vision, driving to that vision, and making sure that everyone in the process is included and understands where we're going to.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, you seem to have led a charmed life. Okay. Has it always been that way?
Well, I wouldn't describe it as a charmed life. I've led a fairly visible in Atlanta life. But obviously, there's issues and difficulties in everything that you do. My currency is ideas. And I think ideas galvanize people. And the way I lead is through ideas. And so if you're able to proffer ideas that people think can help improve their work and therefore their life, they will follow. So I've been very fortunate to have had three great chapters, and the current one we're still writing, three great chapters in my career.
Excellent. Now let's switch to Art. Art, now you've had a diverse career path too, going from Blackwell Consulting Services to CEO of Macquarium to an executive recruiter. Talk to us about your journey.
Sure. So I've also had three chapters as well. And there was a very early brief chapter at the beginning where I was in banking and I started off running participant accounting for a bank that's now part of Chase. So I left there in 92 and went into technology consulting. And I feel like I've been around technology consulting ever since, but in some slightly different capacities. So at one point, I joined Blackwell Consulting Services, joined there in 96 as a programmer, writing code for a living. And over the next 10 years, worked my way up to managing director of the firm and VP of consulting. Basically had everything except the back office reporting to me. But I really felt that I wanted the opportunity to lead the entire organization. And an amazing opportunity presented itself here in Atlanta with kind of a landmark company, Macquarium, and had the opportunity after the untimely passing of the former president, who was a good friend of mine, Kevin Foster, and came down here to take the helm at Macquarium. And it really speaks to the topic that you've teed up for us today around change, because it was a time that there was an opportunity to kind of reimagine, reinvent, you know, Steve was saying, kind of recreate a vision for the firm. And so I was there for about 8 years and then had the opportunity to come over to Russell Reynolds to help lead technology search here in the Southeast. And what I found about myself throughout this whole process is that I like change and I like the newness of change and I like the fresh challenge of a new opportunity. And so I think part of the challenge for all of us as individuals is to figure out, are we the kinds of people who just flourish amid ongoing change, which is, I think, the case for some people, whereas I think some people are much more operationally oriented. They yearn to get to the point where things become steady and predictable, and that you no longer have to keep going through that constant reinvention and ongoing metamorphosis.
Okay. Can you talk to us about some of the challenges that you face, especially within going into an existing structure that had processes, procedures, and also PowerPoints in place? What are some of the challenges you faced and how did you deal with them?
Sure. So I'll tell you both about some very unique challenges as well as just some general recurring themes. One of the most unique challenges when I got here to Atlanta was stepping into a role where I didn't have someone that was a day-to-day manager I was reporting to who could give me the typical onboarding that an employee gets. Basically, there was a very sudden and untimely vacancy that was created. And then you just show up a few weeks later and you're trying to get your bearings and trying to figure out, you know, when things happen that are unexpected, you wonder, does it always happen that way? Is that the first time that that's happened? And, you know, if it's something that is, let's call it suboptimal that happened, and you ask everyone, hey, does that happen a lot? And folks say, oh, no, that was the very first time it happened. But then you scratch your head and say, how come no one seemed surprised when it happened then? You know, in general, the challenges that I've had in my career, keeping in mind that, you know, professional services is all about people. You know, 95% of your costs are people-related costs. And so as a result, when the economy takes a turn, it impacts the people. And I think one of the greatest challenges, and this is just my personal opinion, that if you're the right kind of person to be tasked with stewardship of people, it should never, ever become easy to you to think through the process of letting people go. And I was, you know, in the midst of the dot-com bubble burst and survived and went through the 2008 recession and survived. But those are the most grueling moments where you're looking at people who are incredibly talented and have given everything to the organization and clearly through no fault of their own are now in a situation where you realize we're going to have to let some people go. And the timing is always bad. And I think personally, I think if you're the right person for that job, it can never, ever get easy because you're really reaching deep into people's lives and having an impact that is in many ways irreversible.
You talked about taking over at a time of turmoil, and that takes me to when I first met Steve. Steve had taken on the CEO role of the Atlanta Hawks, when not only was the organization in turmoil, but it also caused the city to be in turmoil. Steve, what caused you to take on that position when you were so successful at Turner?
Well, if I would have known, I don't think I ever would have come over, to be honest with you. I had landed at the Hawks. I've had a little symmetry also. I had 14 years at Coke, 14 years at Turner. And I wanted my third act to be civic, to be something in the community, because I've been so fortunate to have a great career in my hometown where I'm a native. And I was at a dinner and somebody said, could you help us find a CEO for the Hawks? And I said, what about me? And they said, are you serious? And I said, yeah, because I don't think anything unites a city faster than a winning sports organization. What LeBron James has done in Cleveland, what's happening this afternoon in Denver, a million people will be out in the streets celebrating as one. So the vision has always been to excite and unite the city through sports. And unfortunately, through a whole litany of different things, our city got divided because of sports. And so I was kind of a little bit front and center on trying to resolve that. And it was challenging, and it was something I never want to do again, but I think I'm better for it. I know our organization is better for it. And I think that it's something that has propelled the Hawks to be well on that vision of exciting and uniting the city.
What was your biggest surprise when you went into that role? And I can tell you what my biggest surprise was when you called me, because it was out of the blue. And I was actually very disappointed in the events that had taken place. And I happened to be at a fundraiser with Ron Cameron. And I just shared with Ron my disappointment, because I'm a native Atlantan, and I agree, sports unites people. And all of a sudden, we had sports dividing people. And I told Ron about it, and I was actually boycotting the Hawks at that time. And it's something I thought I'd never do. And then the next thing I know, the next day, you called me up out of the blue. Well, first, how did you get my number?
Ryan Cameron. Okay. You know, I had built a relationship with Ryan Cameron. Ryan's a one-of-a-kind talent. As we're doing our radio today, he would probably be in hysterics watching us do this. He is the best in the country on radio. And he said, this is somebody I really respect, and you need to fix this. And I thought it was really important, and I always do. I return every email, every phone call. I think to connect with people and explain the organization. When you're the leader of an organization, you have responsibility that take you outside of necessarily your comfort zone or your convenience zone, that you owe it to people, and you are upset, and you deserved an answer. And we built a very good dialogue, and now we've built a friendship, and we've been able to help participate in things that you care about. We had young ladies observe us from a high school basketball team in a really, really special day. And it's from those kind of interactions that you build relationships. And I think that the next time you might be at a cocktail party or a church function and somebody says something about the Hawks, you'll go, that's a fine organization. And so.
Well, in fact, I initiate those conversations now. Now, the conversation I also initiate is the one having to deal with the rope-a-dope. So, Art.
Yes, sir.
Talk to me about a situation in which the rope-a-dope has been played on you, and how did you respond to it?
Sure. I wanted to harken back to something, actually 2 points that Steve made, because I think there's a strong parallel between what you've observed in the dynamics of a city and in a company. And the two things I wanted to comment on are, number one, you've got to give people a victory. And in the midst of change and bad morale, and the situations you're describing, the division, that's just bad morale on a community-wide scale. You've got to give them some victory that they can point to and feel a sense of accomplishment. And then from that, what you get is a reason to believe. You've got to give the people a reason to believe. And so going back to your question, you know, when I first got here, we had to figure out what is our vision. So I made it very clear. I'm not here to be the second version of the prior leader. He was a great man, and I'm here to kind of take the helm, but I'm not going to try to emulate anybody but me. And I'll do my best to help us articulate a vision. And some of that means that there are some things that are going to change. There are some things that we have done for a long time that are absolutely fantastic. And then there are some things that have become very comfortable to us, and just muscle memory enables us to keep going through. But as a for instance, we need to really get some discipline around execution. And we need to really get crisp in terms of, you know, I'll take you into the minutia of the business, but we've got to get really disciplined around estimating, planning, executing according to budgets and plans, which I know resonates with you from your past life. And what you call the rope-a-dope, I call the bear in the woods defense. And the bear in the woods defense is the way some people think you should deal with a bear when you are confronted in the woods. They respond the same way when confronted with change. And that is stand still, say nothing, hope that it goes away and leaves you alone. And as you would find out,
that's not what I would do if a bear was next to me.
You're a wise man. But some people think the way to survive is stand still, do nothing, and hope that it goes away and leaves you alone. And so the challenge for you as a leader, especially when you're in a highly fluid environment, is there are so many things that are clamoring for your attention. You've got to kind of make a mental checklist of all of the things that need to continue to advance and evolve. And then you begin to kind of cycle through and see which ones are working and which ones aren't. Who's responding and who isn't? And the model that I adopted long ago for myself is, if you think about it as kind of an oscillator, you walk in and the oscillator is set to zero. and you look and see who responds to the call to action. And some people do and some people don't. The ones who respond well, you just kind of let them do their thing. And then you kind of turn it up to one. And then at one, people start to notice, hey, do you notice there's something funny that is kind of picked up for the first time? And so for those folks, you kind of leave it set at one. And systematically, as people respond to change, you kind of drop them off at the appropriate response level. And then there are some people, when you get all the way to 10, they still really haven't responded. And that's the time that you just have to sit down with them and say, hey, listen, you notice that funny buzzing that seems to be picking up volume and getting louder and louder, almost to the point of being uncomfortable. Well, I'm the reason for that. And this isn't working. Okay. And so we're going to have to make a change. Up until now, the opportunity has been for you to change, and now you're actually going to be part of the change. Okay. And you have to have the clarity and fortitude. I think you also have to have the patience with people to say, I really think it's time for you to do something different.
Okay. So you deal with the rope-a-dope directly. Steve, let us hear how you deal with it.
I really admire what you said, because one of the things and one of the mistakes that I've made is new is good, old is bad. And we really got to get to the why. When you talk about that muscle memory doing the same thing, going through and looking at projects, well, we did this last year. Well, why are we doing it? And as a new leader, sometimes when you're in a hurry, you give the overall impression that if it wasn't under your regime, it must be bad. And then people become very defensive and upset that you're not valuing what they do. So what we're trying to do is to get to the why. So why are we doing this activity? Why are we going to this park? Why are we supporting this charity? And making sure that fits our current strategy. When you're an impatient change agent, this is where the balance has to come in, because you can make everybody feel like what they've contributed in the past wasn't important. And that's a mistake I've made before. It's a mistake that I think a lot of leaders make. And what you have to do is modulate that. I like your turning up the volume incrementally. And so we're working real hard to get to the why. Okay. And I think if we can get to the why, it's an elegant way to accomplish the same thing without, because you're forcing people to think and articulate why we are doing this.
Okay. And when you're getting to the why, have there been times in which there were just periods of loneliness, in which when you thought you had the answer, you found out that it wasn't? And if so, how did you deal with those periods of loneliness or those periods of doubt?
Yeah. So I want to comment on asking the question, why? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I would tell people about the organization and the muscle memory is that there is a reason that everything is exactly the way that it is. There is a reason. As long as you understand that reason means explanation, not justification. Okay. I can explain to you why everything is the way that it is, but it may not be a good reason. And so what I would encourage people to do is not just to ask why, receive an answer, and accept it as some kind of immutable truth. Right. And I there's only one analogy that I know. I just have to use the analogy, right? If your wife ever asks, why is the toilet seat up? Right. We can explain why, but please don't confuse that for a justification that it should stay that way.
I have learned something this morning. That is outstanding.
And you will remember that.
I will not forget it.
All right. Now, when it comes to learning things, I remember once I became a very senior officer within the company, and I had thousands of people within my organization, I found out there was a whole lot of jockeying going on at several layers beneath that was actually killing good ideas. You know, as a leader, you're the one who is saying, here's how we're going to allocate our resources. Here's how we're going to prioritize things. Then you have these change leaders who are within the organization. They may be entry level. They may be mid managers. And they are trying to get their voices heard, their ideas heard. But they're the ones who are running smack head first in the status quo that as a leader, you may not even know that's existing. How do you, and in fact, can you take yourself back to those times in which you had an idea, but it wasn't being heard or you weren't getting the traction? What did you do to get your voice heard and to get the idea the exposure that it needed.
So I'll answer that a little bit differently. As the leader, you have the manager's dilemma. Everybody brings you an idea. I wanted a very creative culture. People brought you ideas. And when you shut it down, you discourage people to bring you the next. Yeah. And so I had a very frustrating conversation one day with one of my best people. And she said, you know what? I just can't bring you an idea because you keep saying no. I say, well, I want to say yes, but I can't, I don't agree with it. And I don't want to coddle anybody and spend money on something. I said, you know, I'm damned if I do and damned if I don't. So we sat down that day and we created an employee-based feedback loop. We called it Springboard. And the whole idea was to basically have ideas judged by a jury of your peers. Now, I'm not talking day-to-day management. I'm talking big, investable ideas. Mm-hmm. So if an employee had an idea, and ideas can come from everywhere, it would meet with a quick panel of four or five mid-managers who, if they liked the idea, would connect them to a vice president who would then become their coach and coach the ideas. And for time's sake, I'll end the story by saying we had 200 plus million dollar ideas grow that had nothing to do with me, nothing to do with going up the ladder. But by creating this employee process we called Springboard, which gives your ideas lift, and going through this mechanical process of coaching, of development, of prototyping, we had a huge amount of success.
Excellent. Art?
So I'll tell you a story where I was the beneficiary of someone who dealt with this the best that I've ever experienced or witnessed in my career. My first job, I was in banking, I was an accountant, and I spent all day long just printing off financial statements. And I worked in this giant cube farm full of those old laser jet printers that just throw off heat. And I had stacks and stacks of those old laser jet toner cartridges. And I discovered that you could put them all in a box and send them back to the manufacturer, and you could get a rebate on all of them. And I thought, man, this is just money that we're throwing away. So I started stockpiling them. And then when I had a huge shipment of them, I was about to send them off, and I went to the department head at the time. And I remember, I'm right out of college, went right to the department head, and I explained to him that I wanted to send these in and get a rebate for the bank, but I didn't know who the check should be made out to. And I remember he sternly looked up at me and he said, son, this is a bank. The last thing that we need is money just showing up. And I thought, what? I mean, just, it didn't make any sense to me. And so I was walking back to my work area, and one of his peers saw me kind of walking by with this dazed look, and she asked me what had happened, and I kind of played the whole scene back to her. And she said, well, that's nonsense. We would love to have the money come back in. And so she said, here, you can have it delivered to my department. Here's my department code, et cetera. So a few weeks later, the check came, and I, you know, was so excited. I went running with the check in hand over to show her. And she said, fantastic, let's go deposit it. And she's an officer at a major bank. So we went downstairs and we stood in the teller line, and we handed the check to the teller, and she said, I want to deposit this into the account that's on the check. And the teller looked at her like she was crazy. And she said, well, you know, we can't do that. And so the teller handed her some forms that she had to fill out. And so we stood there in the lobby of the bank for about an hour filling out forms, right? And the entire time, this woman was as happy as can be. She was delightful that we were spending an hour standing in the lobby of the bank filling out these papers so that we could deposit the check. And at the end, we deposited the check. And she shook my hand and she said, thank you very much for my creative thinking, et cetera. And we walked back upstairs. And as soon as I sat down at my desk, I said, that was a horrible use of her time. I thought it was absolutely horrible. But now I understood what he meant, what my boss meant when he said, the last thing we need is money just showing up. Because it's a bank. You can't just have money appear and not know where it came from and fill out a whole lot of forms, et cetera. It was the last time that I ever did it, but it made a huge impression on me. And the net was, she allowed me to learn the why, right? Yeah. Steve was talking about asking why. And I really wanted to know why. And maybe if I had known Steve, I would have realized I should have asked my boss at the time why. But this woman came along and she answered the question why for me.
Excellent. As both of you all were talking, it just made me realize even more that you all are two exceptional leaders. Unfortunately, you're in the minority instead of majority. A lot of people work for average, at best, leaders who don't foster a culture of creativity. What advice would you have for them? And in fact, before you answer that, I want to just share the driver behind my question. When I was at Medtronic, we had created like this innovation fund. And I called it, they started calling it Dallas Dollars. Okay? That if you had a good idea, come. We didn't have as formal of a vetting process, Steve, as you put in. And one of these guys, one of our engineers, had this bright idea of what to do. And he came to me and he said, just give me $25,000 to prove it out. Gave him the $25,000. He proved it. It was so breakthrough that I immediately had him show it to the CEO. The CEO saw it and was like, wow. Well, to make a long story short, within 6 months, that engineer was no longer in the company. His boss got ticked because he took it as a personal assault that he could not find $25,000 in his multi-million dollar budget to give to this engineer to do that project. So then he went out to assassinate the person's character, and he did a great job. The engineer wasn't in my group. He was actually in a different group. He did a great job at assassinating the guy's character, forced him out of the organization. Now, fortunately for that business unit, they came to realize what his manager was no good, and they wound up firing the manager. But that opened up my eyes to, as a leader, everybody within the organization, all the other leaders, different levels, may not share your same philosophy. So how do you keep your finger on the pulse? And then more importantly, if you're somebody, again, who's working for an unsupportive manager, what advice would you give that person, Steve?
Well, I think a lot of this is personal responsibility. You know, these are jobs. These are not life sentences. And if you're working in an environment that you're not happy, you're not respected, my best advice is sometimes it's easier to leave than try to change City Hall.
Excellent.
It's not worth the pain to get to the path. And the other thing is you got to have evolution before revolution. And you have to evolve the way and look at yourself of how you're presenting your ideas, how you're handling yourself. Because maybe that employee, you know, not only should have included the manager in the discussion first, but maybe kept them connected every step of the way. So knowing that this person might be insecure, might be an insecure leader. The problem in most companies is we get rewarded for doing. And every time we do and we do well, we get promoted to manage. And so the idea of being a manager really comes off a timeline of being a great doer. And learning that responsibility that I'm not in charge of the doing anymore, I'm in charge of the leading, is something that I think most companies fail to transition properly. And most people really don't understand why they're in that new capacity. So it's hard when you build your career as a doer to then now be a manager. And it's a transition that takes a long time to make. It took me a couple of years.
Excellent. I'm going to come back to that point because I want to learn the exact things that you did to make that transition. Art, I want to get your comments on. Yep.
So to follow up on what Steve said, I think that when you are in that position where you determine that there's just a fundamental misalignment with your direct supervisor, you've got to decide how to deal with that situation. And I'm a big believer that really the only thing that matters at work is whether you have alignment between yourself and your direct supervisor. I think that if you are marching to the directions of your boss's boss, then you can get yourself in all sorts of problems because there may not be misalignment straight through to all three of you. So back to Steve's point of you may find yourself in a situation where you have to leave. I totally agree. And I would add to it, create the discipline and maturity to decouple the timing of making a decision from the timing of executing a decision. So you may decide, the day that your boss throws you under the bus, you may decide, that's it, I'm leaving. And then you go back to your desk and you leave on a timing that is optimal for you. And you're not waffling, you're not backpedaling or backsliding. What you're doing, from my perspective, is showing the maturity to recognize that I don't have to just make a spur of the moment decision. I don't have to be goaded into quitting my job and slamming the door. And then I walk out and I realized, oh dear, I don't have a paycheck. And now I've made a bad situation worse. So make up your mind, be resolute, go back to your desk, and then figure out a plan. But don't just throw yourself into oncoming traffic just for the sake of argument and saying, see, I told you so, right? The second thing that came to mind on the issue of dealing with those situations. I try to avoid a lot of the back channel, circumvent the manager type stuff, but there are situations where you realize that this is a situation that I'm going to have to mediate us through. And the question that I ask both parties is, what am I going to hear from them on this topic? So you think that your manager is throwing you under the bus, et cetera. So when I go to your manager and ask him or her about this situation, what are they going to tell me, right? And I'm not asking you to tell me whether you agree or you believe. I want to gauge how well do you understand their perspective on this? Because oftentimes what they are trying to do may not work to your advantage, but they may have to optimize on a whole different set of criteria. And I often use the phrase least worst options. Often as managers, we're making choices of least worst options. And so if you have seven people who are your direct reports, each one of whom is entrusted with optimizing, you know, their little seventh of the business. But when it comes to James or it comes to Steve, you've got to weigh all of these options. And chances are, as you go further and further up the organization, the things that get to you aren't easier options to choose between. They get worse and worse and worse. And you're choosing between, you know, whether to push back on contractual terms or knowingly go into an agreement where you recognize that there is an outside chance that it could go sideways on us. And you end up having to choose least worst option. You end up with a salesperson who is frustrated about why we can't close the deal, or a general counsel who's frustrated that I don't feel like you're appreciating the insights that I'm giving you on a problematic contract.
Okay. Excellent. Steve, as you talked about transition, and then I asked a question about what were some of the key, let's say, developmental training or skills you knew you had to add in order to continue moving up the ladder and also having greater influence?
Well, I learned strategy at Coca-Cola. That was a strategy driven company. I learned really deep research at Turner. That was a fact-based driven company. And there's so many skills that one has to acquire and do it every day. You know, my hobby is reading. And from reading comes connections. And most of the ideas that I've had have been inspired or connected to an article I've read, a clip, a magazine. Okay. And I think that the other thing is a common sense approach to management. You can make it science or you can make it, you know, kind of part of your life. And I don't think parenting and managing are very different. You want to be clear in your communication. You want to be kind and treat people the way you want to be treated. You want to lay out a vision and a path what success looks like. Because if I don't know what success looks like, I can never get there. And being a parent is, I think, the best way to learn how to manage. Because if you scream at your kids all day, you're not going to be happy with the end result. And if you scream at your employees all day, you're not going to be happy with the end result. So it's a matter, you know, of using all the different modulations that one has to raising a family. I think also creates a business family, and I'm very blessed to have done that a few times.
But when you think back on it, what was the biggest personal skill? You talked about the technical skills of strategy and research that were aligned with what was valued in those organizations. When we look at it, Steve, the person, were there aspects of you that you had that you knew you had to improve in order to become a more effective leader?
Well, I had a leader at Coke who told me, he said, there's nothing you can't do, but you have to remember how you do it is every bit as important as what you do. I was getting everything done. There was a trail of body bags behind me. And I was very young, and he made me realize that how you get things done is as important as getting it done. And sometimes you can get things done, but you fail on the how you get it done, and it's not successful. So I think a lot of times managers lose perspective, I certainly did, on what the task at hand was, not how you manage the task at hand. And they both are equally important.
Excellent. Art, can you talk about some of the self-improvement things that you've also undertaken?
So years ago, I had an executive coach who pulled me aside, and he said he wanted to share something with me that a mentor had shared with him. And he quoted the line from the movie, I See Dead People. Do you remember the movie?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so what he shared with me was that the two of us both had this kind of supernatural ability to see things that other people don't see, but that are real. And what he shared with me is that I needed to understand that the reason I was in the role that I was in is because I have that ability to see these things, but that I needed to learn to be patient with other people because they have no idea what you're talking about. And there's nothing wrong with them. That's why I'm in the role and they're not. And there's nothing wrong with me. Likewise, that's why I'm in this role. But I needed to be more patient with them and help them understand that there are things that are real. I'm not hallucinating. I'm not dreaming or having visions. These are real things, and I'm going to try to help you address these things and respond to them appropriately. And that's just something that I've tried to take with me, to be mindful that is why some of us are in the roles that we're in. And then subsequent to that, I had a manager who never really said it, but what I saw from him was that the greatest value that I could bring to my people as a leader was not to always remember the way they were 10 years ago when they made a really dumb mistake, or to tell them how they're going to be 20 years from now when they just can't even imagine. You know, imagine when someone had come to you and said, James, let me tell you what you're going to end up doing at Medtronic one day. And you would think, man, I don't even know what you're talking about, right? But what he showed me was the greatest value I could bring is to help them visualize who they are becoming just beyond their horizon that they can see, and continue to reinforce what they're about to become that's just outside of their reach. And that's really what I've tried to do.
Well, it sounds like both of you were fortunate to have excellent mentors, sponsors, and people in your lives to give you feedback that you then took it to heart. When you think about the people that you are now mentoring and sponsoring, are you seeing some common things that they need to be aware of that our audience can also just think about? Let's start with you, Art, since you're in the business of filling positions for companies. So you know what people are doing to lose those positions, okay? And you also know what companies are looking for in the people to fill them. Let's first start out with, what are you seeing that's derailing most leaders now?
Yeah. So a few things come to mind. First, I would say that this whole issue of leaving the trail of broken bodies behind you is something that adds up pretty quickly. Secondly, I think that at the end of the day, it comes down to execution and creating value. And if you are not executing and not creating value at an executive level, then you have a very, very short shelf life. But what people, I think, are saying is, we are not willing to have that at the expense of a trail of broken bodies. I think over the long term, what I've observed in the past couple of years is, having come out of this recession and businesses are beginning to sense that the economy is picking up, they're going to their leaders, and I do a lot of work in technology, and so they're going to their technology leaders, and they're saying, James, now we really need to kick it into gear and be innovative and transformational, et cetera. And people are kind of looking back at them with this glazed look and saying, well, that's what I've been doing. And the challenge is that you've done so, you've done more with less for so long that you've kind of atrophied those muscles that give you the ability to pivot and transform, et cetera. And so I think that that is one of the things that is unfortunately causing the demise of a lot of really talented people, just the ability, they've lost that ability to spring back to life.
Okay. Excellent. We have about 5 more minutes left. Let's get closing comments from both of you all on the main ways to go about dealing with the personal challenges of leading change.
I think if I could give one bit of advice today, I call it play in the gray. The world's not black and white anymore. What made sense in the morning might not make sense in the afternoon as fast as our world is changing. And what I'm finding are that people who can see the shades of gray and take what we are trying to do and not be literal all the time. And I think that's going to be the most important skill, is to be able to play in the unknown, play in the gray. And so that's what we're all trying to teach our people.
Excellent.
All right. I think you've got to have clarity on both kind of where your core is and what I would call a true north. So what is it that is the foundation that your leadership principles rest on? And I think you've got to be clear both with yourself and with your team. And by team, I don't just mean the people who report to you, but basically the entire circle of folks who are around you, and let them know this is the way I approach decision making. This is the way that I deal with conflict, et cetera. I've met some great leaders who actually create user manuals that say, basically, here's how to interact with me, and you know where I'm coming from. And then I think you've got to be really clear on the true north. So where are we heading? And I think you've got to distill that down to something that, you know, A.G. Lafley used to refer to as being Sesame Street simple. Mm-hmm. It can't be something that takes 15 minutes to explain. It's got to be a short soundbite. You keep repeating it over and over and over again until people begin repeating it. And the ones who repeat it have now kind of become your spokespeople for the change. And then you can kind of move on to the change after the change.
Excellent. Well, the takeaway from today's show is that how to be a change leader and how to influence within status quo is that you have to understand it and then work within it in order to make a difference, in order to take the organization to a higher level. We want to thank both Steve and Art for their time and for the wisdom that they've shown us. Now, in closing, the Dallas Diamond. I always end the show with a Dallas Diamond. And when Art was talking about you never make a decision immediately, I refer to that as you never keep it real. Because keeping it real always goes wrong. Okay? So anytime you hear something personal, the way you have to respond to it is professional. For example, anytime somebody starts out a sentence with, now this isn't personal, that means they're getting ready to say something personal to you. If they started out with all due respect, that means they're getting ready to disrespect you. How you handle those comments, those situations, will determine how high you rise and the impact that you're going to have. So keeping it real always goes wrong. Now, next show, the topic is going to be how to go from success to significance. Pete Carrell is going to be our guest, the retired CEO of Georgia Pacific, who transformed the company from a commodity-based one to a consumer products one, creating $44 billion in value. More importantly, at last count, five people who worked for Pete went on to become CEOs at other companies. And he went on to play a key role, in fact, a leading role, in saving Grady Hospital. Our other guest, Frank Bell, who founded IntelliNet, an IT consulting company in 93, and he founded the Georgia CIO Association in 2003, in which the mission is to inspire CIOs to achieve their leadership potential. In closing, you can contact me through my website at J. Dallas and Associates, also through both Twitter and Facebook at H. James Dallas, okay, and also a hashtag ChangeMasters. In closing, let's continue being the change. Until next time, goodbye.